You got all caught up on all your studying for this class? Yeah. People are smiling. That's good. Breaks are good. All right. I want to finish up talking about membranes in general, and then I will move on to our next topic, which is transport across membranes, which is a very relevant topic for us this term. Last time when I finished, I talked about proteins that could cross the membrane, and I described to you that they would have some characteristic chemical properties based on the fact that they are interacting with very nonpolar portions of the membrane when they're on the inside of the membrane. What I want to talk about today to start with are to characterize membranes themselves in a little bit different way. And part of this is very general, just sorts of information. And one of the things that I want you to keep in mind with respect to a biological membrane is that a biological membrane is a very fluid substance. It's fluid. It behaves like a fluid. We see that there's flexibility to it, there's movement within it, and that movement we can actually study very carefully, or very nicely if we're careful. What you see on the screen is an experiment demonstrating the fluidity of a membrane, and that fluidity of a membrane is studied by embedding dyes that are sensitive to a laser in the molecules of the membrane itself. And what happens is that the dye, when it's exposed to a laser, will actually get bleached. So it actually, you have a color change associated with that blasting that hits it with a laser beam. If you study that over time and you watch the rate with which that bleaching disappears, that is, the rate with which that color disappears, you can get an idea about how fast things in that membrane are literally diffusing around. And what you discover is things are moving fairly rapidly. Okay? You can see here's the event where we have the measurement of the color that is in that particular cell, a bleaching event with a laser beam, and then on the order of less than seconds where we see this recovery that's happening, where that this recovery that's happening is because unbleached molecules are, in fact, diffusing into that place where we had in the membrane the bleached portion. So we can actually measure that rate of diffusion by doing an experiment like this. And so we can actually see that recovery happening as a result. No big point. The main point just being that we have flexibility. And that is that there is fluidity associated with these membranes. It turns out that for membranes to be functional for a cell, they really have to be fluid. All right? That's a very, very important consideration. Fluidity is very, very important for the proper functioning of a membrane. One of the ways in which we can see fluidity, or two of the ways in which we can see fluidity, are known as lateral versus transverse diffusion. So they're both diffusion type processes that are happening. One occurs much more commonly than the other. So in the top figure, we can see a lipid bilayer that has a specifically marked molecule. You can see it in red there. And you see that in this lateral diffusion, what's happening is the red guy is shifting places on the same side of the membrane. In this case, it's going from position number 2 to position number 3. And that movement that happens on one side of the membrane, it could happen down here as well, is very, very rapid. All right? So lateral diffusion happens very, very quickly across a membrane. However, if we look at that same molecule here in red and we measure the rate with which it now appears on the other side of the membrane, that process is called transverse diffusion. That process occurs very, very slowly. So molecules tend to stay on one side of a membrane. And there are, in fact, enzymes that are known to cause a molecule to flip from one side to the other. They have a very complicated name. They're known as flipases, okay? Which I always think of flipping somebody off when you're doing that, but it's not quite what it is. But a flipase flips a molecule from one side of the membrane to another, and they facilitate transverse diffusion. They have nothing to do with lateral diffusion. Lateral diffusion happens quite readily. Now, as I said, the fluidity of a membrane is very, very important consideration. We can think of a membrane as behaving something like a liquid or a solid. All right? And I'm using those terms a little bit loosely here, but we can imagine a more ordered structure in the membrane would be more consistent with a solid, and a less ordered structure in the membrane would be more consistent with a liquid. That's kind of what we see at the molecular level that happens when we take a substance through its melting point. Okay? Now, this shows the transition that's happening for a biological membrane and going from a solid-like state to a liquid-like state. And not surprisingly, that transition happens over a range of temperature, kind of like it does when we thaw ice, right? So when we thaw ice, there's a temperature at which that transition occurs. For a biological membrane, it's actually not a specific point, but we see a sort of a range of temperature over which that transition occurs. The midpoint of that transition has a name. It's called the TM. You can think of it as the melting temperature if you want, but we'll call it TM. And it's the midpoint of that transition. Now, I talked about cholesterol last week, and one of the things that cholesterol does is it widens that transition temperature. It doesn't change the transition temperature, but it may make it start way over here and make it go all the way up over here, something like that. So cholesterol widens the range of the transition without changing the actual TM. Now, as I said, having biological membranes be fluid is very, very important for their proper function. And cells have ways of controlling what the TM of a membrane is. It turns out that what they do is they vary the amount of unsaturated fatty acids that they have in their glycerophospholipids and in their sphingolipids. The more unsaturated fatty acids they have, the lower their TM will be. I'll repeat that. The more unsaturated fatty acids they have in their membrane lipids, the lower the TM will be. That means that at a lower temperature, something that has a lot of unsaturated fatty acids in it will be more likely to be fluid than something at a high that has a high amount having a low amount of unsaturated fatty acids. All right? On the other hand, if I want to have a higher melting temperature, I would tend to have more saturated fatty acids in my membranes. Now, a prime place where we see evidence of this is if we look in the ocean. In the ocean, we discover that the temperature of the ocean is, especially in these parts of the world, fairly chilly, and that fish that are swimming around in that water are exposed to very cold temperatures. If we want them to have fluid membranes, we might imagine that they would have a need for a greater amount of unsaturated fatty acids in their membranes than we would have living out here in the nicely climate-controlled environments. And in fact, that's exactly what we see. Fish oil, everybody knows, is very high in polyunsaturated fatty acids. And part of the reason that they're that is because of this phenomenon with respect to the fluidity of membranes. Okay? So fish oil is high in polyunsaturates to help keep the membranes fluid at a lower temperature. Yes, sir?
So the colder the native habitat of the fish, the higher that proportion would be?
In general, that's the case, yeah. In general, that's the case, yeah. So his question was, the lower the temperature in which the fish lives, the higher the amount of unsaturated fatty acids. And in general, that's true. Yes, sir? So his question is, you know, there's a lot of variation in fish with respect to fatty acids and so forth. How does this all apply? I'm talking about general phenomena now with respect to fatty acids. And yes, you will see ranges of fatty acids present in fish for different reasons besides membranes. Okay? But from a membrane perspective, what I'm talking about is pretty much the case. Okay? Yep. Good. All right. So that's the case with fluidity with respect to membranes. There is simply an illustration of this phenomenon that I'm describing to you. Here we see something that has 18 carbons, no double bonds, and its transition temperature is 58. Here's something with 18 carbons and one double bond, and its transition temperature is minus 22. So that single double bond made a heck of a difference in the melting temperature. You'll also notice that the shorter the fatty acids are, the lower that melting temperature is also. Here's something that's 22 versus something that's 14. We go from 75 down to 24. So shorter, more unsaturated will lower the melting temperature. Longer, more saturated will raise that melting temperature. Okay. Part of the reason that that happens is the more saturated the fatty acids are, the more easily they are to get ordered. And as I said, ordered is a model for freezing, as it were. And so this shows, this depicts on the screen, three unsaturated fatty acids, as we would find in a three saturated fatty acids, as we would find in a fat. And here's the same thing with an unsaturated fatty acid. And you can imagine that this would be a lot harder to order. And to order something that's physically different like this, it takes a lower temperature to do that. And that's why we see the lower melting temperature for the membranes that contain the unsaturated fatty acids. Cholesterol fits into membranes, not surprisingly, like this. And you can see that they're arranged in this way. This little round thing here is used to depict that single hydroxyl group that's on there. And so you can see it's kind of hanging out up here near the hydrophilic end, but everything else is pretty much buried in that tail of the lipid bilayer. Okay. Now, one of the things I'm going to talk about, and I'll talk about it in a bit again to remind you, is that substances have to move across membranes. Cells have a very, very important thing that they have to do. And I want to spend a couple minutes talking about this to kind of give you an idea of the importance of what you see on the screen here. What you see on the screen is a membrane protein. It's an integral membrane protein. And it performs a function for the cell that is going to be the topic of most of the rest of today's lecture, and that is active transport. This guy is transporting ions across a membrane. And we call it active transport because energy is required for the movement. Energy is required for the movement. And the reason energy is required for the movement, and this is something you're going to want to write down, is because at least one molecule is being moved against a concentration gradient. So active transport is a phenomenon that occurs across membranes when at least one molecule is moved against a concentration gradient. Now, because at least one molecule is being moved against a concentration gradient, energy is required. But the definition of active transport is not that energy is required. The definition is that at least one molecule is being moved against a concentration gradient. All right. Well, what's going on with this? Why do we even bother with moving things across a concentration gradient? Well, when I say across a concentration gradient, what I'm talking about is moving something from a low concentration to a higher concentration. Low on one side, higher on the other. And I'm moving it in the direction of the higher concentration. That's not the way diffusion normally goes. And so the reason energy is required for these is because you're fighting the phenomenon of diffusion, which normally wants to go the other way, from high concentration to low. Why does the cell bother with pumping? In this case, what it's doing is it's using the energy of ATP, that's shown here, to transport out of the cell three sodiums and to transport into the cell two potassiums. Why does the cell bother to do this? Well, I want to tell you the reason why the cell does that. When I talked about the lipid bilayer first, the thing I told you about it was the fact that, surprisingly, water could move across the membrane fairly easily. Most substances couldn't do that. Ions can't do that. Glucose can't do that, at least not very readily. But water can. So water has the ability to go across that membrane. The membrane is not too much of a barrier for water. Well, if you perform the experiments that you probably did in either high school biology class or college biology class where you learn something about osmosis, you take a membrane, a bag, okay, and you fill it full of, let's say, a protein, and you close it off and you dump it into a solution, what happens to that membrane if water can move across the membrane? It starts to swell because water is diffusing in to dilute out the protein, but the protein can't make it out, and so the thing gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It will eventually burst. Well, we've got the same situation right here. Water can move across this membrane, and we've got proteins and things on the inside that can't get out. Uh-oh, if we're not careful, we are going to burst. Well, cells have to continually fight that battle. And they fight that battle by adjusting ionic concentrations. You see a prime example of it right here. Okay? If cells stop this pumping phenomenon that you see on the screen, the osmotic balance, which otherwise is balanced, will get tipped in the wrong direction. The cell will start to swell and swell and eventually explode and die. So one of the prices that cells pay for living, the cost of living as it were, is maintaining an osmotic balance that keeps it from exploding. Now it's a complicated thing. I'm simplifying it here for you. But suffice it to say that by pumping sodiums out and potassiums in, making artificial concentration gradients of those two ions, the cell is creating an osmotic equilibrium, as it were, that keeps it from bursting. If it stops doing this, it's in trouble. So your cells are continually doing exactly what you see on the screen to keep themselves from bursting. This is active transport because, again, we're moving things against a concentration gradient. In this case, the sodium is in lower concentration on the inside than it is on the outside. We're moving it against that gradient. And potassium is higher on the inside than it is on the outside, and moving it against that concentration gradient. So in this case, we're moving both things against the concentration gradient. Okay, I'll stop there, take questions. Yeah? We are disrupting osmotic balance, but we're disrupting it in a way that water is, as it were, confused. So water is happy with the imbalance that we create because we have to think about there's many, many things that could be balanced here. And by balancing it in this way, water is much less likely to come in. If we don't create this imbalance, water will come in. And as I said, it's a complicated story that I'm simplifying for you here. But suffice it to say, this imbalance must be created and maintained in order for a cell to keep from exploding. Yes, sir?
Not to take it in a morbid direction, but for a living higher animal, when they pass away, is that part of the reason that their body swells?
So for a living organism, when it dies, is this one of the reasons that a body swells? You know, I honestly don't know the answer to that question, but there's a lot of things that's happening in death that I would suspect would, in fact, probably have to do with some damage to cells, yes, but I don't know that. Yes, sir.
This kind of protein exists in the other, ectoplasm of the vacuum. That membrane has the same kind of protein on it, or
you're talking about this transport protein?
Yeah.
Yeah. So his question was, does this transport protein exist on a wide variety of cells? And the answer is virtually every cell. Yeah.
I mean,
Does it exist on the organelle membrane? There are other considerations for organelle membranes. No, this is on the plasma membrane. Yeah?
Is there any way for sodium and potassium to cross the cell membrane? Because if you keep on doing that, then you'll just have all the sodium going up
to the cell, right? Well, okay, so the question is there any way for these guys to make their ways back? Otherwise, we just basically deprive the cell completely of sodium and completely, and we're full of potassium, right? Well, as we will see when I start talking on the transport system, there are limits to this, all right? The more of a concentration gradient we make, the harder it is to put more out or move more in, all right? Just like if we were trying to pump water up to the upper layer up here and there's a big balloon. The more water there is up there, the harder it is to pump additional water up. So when we fight that concentration gradient, after a while, the concentration gradient is going to say, you're not going any further. So you can't completely deprive a system of ions in this way. Okay? Okay, good. So that's a very cool thing. You'll see this pump come up in a thing in just a second. Bacterial membranes are a lot more complicated than the membranes of our cells, bacterial membranes. If you think about it, bacteria have quite a wide variety of environments in which they can find themselves. They actually have to have a cell wall to protect them. They don't have the rest of the body, as it were, protecting them. And that cell wall provides some strength. It also provides them with sort of a barrier, an even better barrier with the outside environment. So what you see is a sort of schematic of the equivalent of a plasma membrane down here, a lipoprotein membrane out here, lipopolysaccharide membrane on the outside. And the construction of this lipopolysaccharide cell wall, as it were, that bacteria have, is one of the strategies for the use of antibiotics. Penicillin, for example, interferes with the construction of this outer membrane of bacteria, the outer cell wall. And by interfering with the ability of the bacterium to make that cell wall, the bacteria actually die. And so that's a very important consideration. There's another depiction of it. And internal membranes. We look inside of organelles of cells, related to your question over here. The internal organelles of cells are themselves also bounded by membranes. And they have, in many cases, characteristics that are different from those of the plasma membrane. But suffice it to say, the same general idea is involved in making those membranes. We have a lipid bilayer. And the composition of that will vary a bit from one membrane to the next. The last thing I want to point out to you, and this is something I'll come back and talk about later in the term, is the phenomenon that you see on the screen. And it's a process called receptor-mediated endocytosis. Okay? Receptor-mediated endocytosis. The mouthful name I just gave it is shown right here, receptor-mediated endocytosis. And this phenomenon turns out to be very, very important for cells to get cholesterol in them. We'll talk about cholesterol later in the term, and I'll tell you at that time that there's three things we have to consider in the cholesterol levels in an organism. One of them is due to what you see on the screen right here. Cholesterol can be moved in the body, and it's moved in the body through complexes we call LDLs, low-density lipoproteins. We'll say more about those later as well. The low-density lipoproteins contain in them a core that contains cholesterol. And cells that are needing cholesterol will make a receptor that will bind to LDL. So they have a structure on their surface where a protein on this receptor region binds to a protein on the LDL. When these two guys attach to each other, the LDL is internalized. And you see this internalization happening here. It's pulling in LDLs. You see this thing sort of butt off. And now, on the inside of the cell, we have these LDLs that have been brought in that have cholesterol in them. So this process that you see on the screen, as I said, is called receptor-mediated endocytosis. And it's how cells get cholesterol from the outside in. So it's yet another way of crossing a membrane. Another way of crossing a membrane. Okay. So those are the general things I want to say about membranes. I'd like to turn our attention now to talk about membrane transport. And I've already introduced the topic. Yes, sir, Lawrence. What's that? What does LDL stand for? LDL stands for low density lipoprotein. And I'll talk about that, as I said, later in the term. LDLs, your doctor will tell you, is bad cholesterol because it's the LDLs that contain cholesterol. Okay. Well, membrane transport. You've already seen the introduction now to membrane transport. And I hope you're starting to get an idea about the importance of membrane transport. One is you need membrane transport for sodium and potassium ions to keep the cell from just blowing up. That's pretty important. Cells have to get nutrients. Cells have to get glucose. They have to get food. They have to get amino acids. They have to get a lot of things inside of them so they can stay alive. And those things don't cross membranes easily by themselves. That means that cells have to have proteins that help to bring them in. And in many cases, those molecules that are being brought in are being brought in against a concentration gradient, meaning an active transport is involved. Well, there are two types of transport that we want to consider in this class, what's called active transport and passive transport. Okay? Passive transport does not involve any molecule being moved against the concentration gradient. It simply is the process of going from high concentration to low concentration. What's an example? Well, an example would be the GLUT transporters that we talked about before that were the ones that allowed glucose to move across the membrane. Our blood cells are full of GLUTs. These are the proteins in the membrane of the blood cell that allow glucose to move through them. It turns out that in our bloodstream, the concentration of glucose is higher outside of cells than it is inside of cells. So all that the blood cell needs is something that only allows glucose through, and glucose will simply diffuse through it, going from high on the outside to low on the inside. Nothing is being moved against the concentration gradient, and that means, therefore, we have what we refer to as passive transport. Some people call it simple diffusion, but I think that's a confusing thing because it actually requires a transport protein. But there's no molecule being moved against a concentration gradient. The only energy as such is the energy of diffusion, high concentration to low. Yes, sir?
When you say concentration gradient, I've always heard it described as an electrochemical gradient. Does that take into consideration the electronic component as well?
Okay, so he's asking, does concentration gradient equate with the term electrochemical gradient? In the case of glucose, it equates with the term chemical gradient because glucose is not charged. But it could be, if it were an ion, then it could be electro as well. So it depends on the nature of the molecule. So I'm talking about a concentration gradient. I'm simply talking about concentration is all. That concentration could be charge. That concentration could be a specific molecule. It could be both. Okay? Okay. Now, here is a figure that I don't want you to waste too much time on. Basically, it's telling us what? It tells us that concentration is associated with energy. If you think about it, that makes sense. That's why things tend to want to move from a high concentration to a lower concentration. Right? It's energetically favorable for them to move from a high to a low. So if we want to take something from a low to a high, we're going to have to put energy in. So if we have at least one thing going against a concentration gradient, we're going to have an external source of energy to make sure that we have enough energy to fight that gradient. If we have the situation I talked about with the GLUTs in the red blood cell, there's nothing to fight. The higher concentration of glucose out, lower concentration in, it automatically moves in. No additional energy is required. Okay. Now, blah. And this is to bring up what Jody just said in the front, that what I just described to you is a simple concentration. Okay. This shows that the same phenomenon holds with respect to charge. So just as a chemical concentration of, say, glucose on one side versus glucose on the other side will have energy associated with it, so too will a charge difference. If we have more positive charge on the outside than we have on the inside, that means that positive is going to want to move in, and negative is going to want to move out. So chemical gradients, electrical gradients, both of these are critical energy considerations for moving things across membranes. Okay. Well, I start this topic with something that your book starts with, which is we don't even talk about it until later in the book, but I'll talk about it one of the first things. It's this molecule that you see on the screen called phosphoaspartate. Now, this molecule is relevant because it is a transient intermediate in the action of certain proteins that use ATP in active transport. This molecule is formed transiently by some ATP-using transport proteins. Okay? They are ATP-using, and it turns out that in the ATP use, one of the first things that happens in the action of these proteins is a phosphate from ATP becomes transiently attached to the side chain of an aspartic acid residue. That makes the phosphoryl aspartate. Okay. The sodium-potassium ATPase that I just showed you is one such example. These are proteins, and they have a name, that are called P-type transporters. P, the letter P, type transporters. P-type transporters will have this phosphoaspartate as an intermediate in their action. So phosphoaspartate appears as an intermediate in the action of P-type ATP transport proteins. Yes, sir?
Is that aspartate floating around by itself, or is it?
It's part of the protein. So the aspartate is a side chain of the protein. And so like we saw in the serine proteases, where we had the alkoxide ion that played that role, it was a side chain of the serine. This is a side chain of an aspartic acid, and it plays a role in this process. We're not going to go through the mechanism of that, but suffice it to say that this is an intermediate in that process. Okay. Excuse me. All right. Well, let's look at a simple pump. This is a very simple pump. Okay. It depicts a protein in a membrane. It is specific for a specific molecule, and yes, we generally see that proteins that do transport are very specific for very specific molecules. It will only allow certain molecules to pass through them. Now, as we look at this, we see this, here's the molecule being transported, it comes in, it fits nicely into here, and then once it gets in there, the protein sort of changes its shape so that the open region, instead of pointing outwards, points inwards, and the molecule comes in. This is a very simple depiction of transport. This could be either active or passive transport. All right? If this guy is being moved against the concentration gradient, it is an active transport. If it is moving simply with the concentration gradient, it is a passive transport. Okay? The only energy being input, if it's a passive, is just the energy of diffusion. There's no other energy that's needed in passive transport. If it's active transport, then there are a, and you might want to underline this, if it's active transport, there are a variety of possible energy sources. A variety of them. We're going to talk about a couple of them. ATP is a common one, but ATP is not the only one. All right. Let's take a look at a P-type ATP-using transport protein. All right? This is a protein that is involved in transporting calcium, and it's moving calcium against a concentration gradient. Moving calcium against a concentration gradient across a membrane. This could be outside the cell to inside the cell, or even within an organelle within the cell. For our purposes, it doesn't matter at this point. Here's the membrane, whether it's the organelle membrane or the cell membrane. And what this is trying to do is move calcium from the lower place down here to outside the membrane here. All right, so what's happening? Well, the first thing that we see in that process is, in this case, two calcium ions bind to specific locations inside of the transport protein. ATP comes in. And right there is our little side chain of aspartic acid. The phosphate gets transferred to the aspartic acid, and the transfer of that phosphate to the aspartic acid causes, and here we go again, a slight shape change in the protein. That slight shape change in the protein is what is responsible for now opening this thing towards the outside instead of the inside. Okay? So here's the phosphate on there, shape change, and now we've got the opening pointing outside, and calcium goes out. Calcium may get kicked out in that process, which is what it's going to have to physically do if it's working against a concentration gradient. Everything else then is back to resolving the initial condition. Water comes in, releases the phosphate. Release of the phosphate causes the shape change back to the original state, and we're back where we were. Now, I'm not so worried about you memorizing the steps in this process. It's not doesn't really matter to me if you know that calcium comes in first and then ATP, et cetera, et cetera. But I do want you to understand the role of ATP here. ATP is an energy source that's putting a phosphate on here, and that's what's driving the whole process. The addition of the phosphate to that aspartic acid residue is causing a shape change that results in the expulsion, in this case, of calcium. Yes, sir?
If the concentration of the thing being transported gets high enough, are these theoretically reversible? Could you generate ATP, or is there a one-way step?
Very good question. So he just asked, if the concentration of this got so high, could this reverse and actually make ATP? Okay? Some pumps can do that. Some pumps can do that. Yes. Okay. What's that?
Can the calcium come back from outside of the?
It is possible if we had something else that was making the outside calcium concentration be very high. Okay. It won't go for very long, but it's possible that you can do that. Yes. Okay. It's not a major energy source for the cell because it's not going to last very long. Okay. So that is how a P-type ATPase, I call it a P-type ATP transport protein. Some people also refer to it as a P-type ATPase is what they call it. So both of those terms are acceptable. Okay. Here shows you that sodium-potassium gradient that I talked about before. There it is doing its thing. And now we see it in the context of this cell doing something else. And this is kind of cool. Okay? This is kind of cool. Notice that we're increasing the concentration of sodium outside the cell by the action of that pump that you've already seen. Okay? Concentration of sodium is getting high. What did I tell you to start this about the concentration gradient in terms of energy? There's potential energy there, right? We have a high concentration of sodium outside the cell. Does sodium want to come inside the cell? Yes, it does. Okay? That's an energy source. It turns out that, especially in heart cells, this, I got to tell you, but not in heart cells, in some cells, they use the sodium gradient as a way of bringing in glucose. So cells that are in a portion of the body that don't have a high concentration of glucose outside may need to actively transport glucose in, that is to move glucose against the concentration gradient in. Those cells can use a sodium gradient as their energy source to bring in glucose. So a concentration gradient can actually be an energy source for a transporter, for an active transporter. That's a little confusing to students sometimes. How can a concentration gradient play a role in an active transport? And that's where we come back to that definition that I gave you. The definition I gave you was we have at least one molecule being moved against a concentration gradient. In this case, glucose is being moved against a concentration gradient. Sodium is moving with a concentration gradient, and so it's the movement of the sodium that's helping to bring that glucose in. Okay, I'm saying a lot there. Let me slow down and take questions. There's usually a lot of questions about this guy right here. I can tell you guys have been gone on break. Karen, was that a question? So the only place where the sodium and the glucose have any interaction at all is at the place where the protein, where they're coming in. Out here, no, they have no association at all. Yes?
Is
That's a very good question. Does it have two channels? It has the ability, yes, to bring both in. And we see this commonly happen in proteins. We saw it actually right here. There's one channel for sodium and one channel for potassium, and there's each one is specific for each one. Yep. Yes? So I think what you said, that is the mechanism such that this cannot happen unless both have loaded, and the answer is that's correct. So these are basically requiring both things to bind before any one of them will come through. Yes, Neil. The energy ultimately is coming from ATP, but the energy of all things are ultimately coming from ATP. Or if we want to really go ultimate, we say to the sun, or we say to, you know, it's where we draw the line. But in this particular process, it's specifically sodium ions. But yes, ATP was driving that. So we have to draw a line where we're saying that that energy source is. Okay. So that's kind of a cool process. Excuse me. I want to tell you about a cool molecule, digitoxigenin. Digitoxigenin is something that's made by foxglove. And it is a nasty compound if it's not used properly. Because what it does is it blocks the action of the sodium-potassium ATPase. The sodium-potassium transporter, the thing that was keeping our cells happy so they don't blow up. This guy's a poison. But it actually has medicinal uses in small quantities. And I want to tell you one of those medicinal uses that's really interesting if you're interested in how the heart works. Okay? Now, the heart, as you know, depends upon calcium, like any muscle does, for contraction. Okay? It depends on calcium for contraction. When we see the contraction of a muscle, we see calcium stimulating the contraction, and then we see the pumping out of calcium to reduce that concentration so the contraction can happen again. Okay? The heart is no different than anything else. The heart, like other cells in the body, have a sodium-potassium ATPase. So they have a system that's very much like this guy right here. In addition, they have another transporter that's of considerable interest. This other transporter that they have uses a sodium gradient to pump calcium out. So part of that flushing of the muscle cell to get the calcium out requires sodium coming in at the same time calcium is going out. They go in opposite directions. Okay? Digitoxigenin in small doses is used to stimulate a more vigorous heartbeat. How does it work? Well, based on what I just told you, I hope that you'll be able to figure it out, but I'll tell you, all right? What's happening is we give digitoxigenin in low doses, and maybe we target the heart for this. What are we going to do to the sodium-potassium ATPase? It's going to slow down, right? If it slows down, what's going to happen to the concentration of sodium outside the cell? It's going to fall. If the concentration of sodium outside the cell falls, what happens to the ability to pump calcium out of the cell? It will also fall. Digitoxigenin is keeping the calcium concentration higher in the heart cell to cause it to contract harder. It's a way to stimulate the heart to beat harder. And it's used sometimes for people who have congestive heart failure where their heart is not beating hard enough. So it's artificially keeping that calcium concentration in the heart muscle cell high. Can't do this forever, obviously. But over a short period of time, it can actually stimulate the heart to beat harder and do the pumping that's necessary to keep the person alive. A very cool application of our knowledge of membrane transport. Okay, questions about that? Usually there are. You're a quiet group today. This is the quietest I've seen the class the whole term. Yes, sir?
Is there another name? Is there like a general name for it, like if it were being used in a hospital?
Are there other names for it? There may well be, but the one we'll use is digitoxigen. Yeah. Digitoxin, you see that some? Yeah. Okay, let's do one last thing and then we'll call it a day. And the last thing I want to talk about here, actually I have two things, are a class, another class of proteins that use ATP to do active transport. So I described the P-type ATPases to you as one example. They were the ones that used that phosphoaspartate or phosphoryl aspartate, same thing. What you see on the screen is a schematic representation of another class of ATP-using transporters. They're called ABC transporters. And ABC transporters use a different mechanism. They do not use phosphoaspartate. We're not going to go into their mechanism. They have a schematic structure, something like what you see on the screen. And my only purpose in showing you this is just to let you know that there are other ways that ATP energy can be used to do pumping. Now, there are some very interesting proteins that are, in fact, ATP type transport. I'm sorry, ABC type transporters. One of the most interesting ones is this guy right here, multidrug resistance protein, also called MDR. And there are many versions of this type of protein that are found in cells almost across all of biology. We have a protein like this in our body, and some bacteria have a protein like this. And what they do is they use the energy of ATP to pump toxic substances outside of them. And they have a wide variety of substances that they will grab. They're not very specific. It's one of the few transporters that's not very specific in terms of what they will grab. Well, imagine that you are trying to kill a bacterium with an antibiotic, and the bacterium gets one of these transporters and has the ability to kick the antibiotic outside of itself where it needs to be inside to work. What's going to happen to the effectiveness of that antibiotic? It's going to go down, right? The same thing happens in our bodies with some types of chemotherapy. The chemotherapeutic drugs that we give are very good at killing cells, but cancer cells that figure out, oh, this is the thing that's killing me, let's pump it all on out, become resistant to it as a result of that. So multi-drug resistance protein is a very important protein that's an ABC type transporter. Yes, sir?
So what's the basis of its selectivity for exporting things?
What's the basis of its selectivity for selecting things? It tends to favor fairly nonpolar molecules. It doesn't tend to favor very specific shapes or anything like that, but it tends to favor nonpolar molecules. And many drugs are in that category. So that tends to just kick them out and they're set. But it's not a very specific protein at all.
Do they have any tags or flags on their own protein so they don't just turn themselves inside out?
I would assume they have some way of knowing what's me and what's not me, but I can't tell you that. Okay, let's call it a day there, and I'll see you guys on Friday. What's that?
Her administration is being evacuated. I got about half the text.
For what?
It says for some sort of public safety. I was trying to find out what the remainder of it is.
Oh, I have my phone turned off.
Here's what I have so far. I generally don't have my phone out, but that came through.
Whoa, that looks serious. No. That's odd.